Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Aurora Orchestra. I had thought only non-native speakers like me would slightly struggle in trying to pronounce the illustrious name of this British orchestra correctly. So it was a relief to hear from its founder and principal conductor Nick Collen that even some Brits have got trouble saying Aurora Orchestra without swallowing their tongues. Welcome to another episode of our podcast series at Philharmonie Talk. It aims to bring you a bit closer to one of the most astonishing young orchestras coming from England these days. In early September, they will perform two concerts in a row at the Proms in the Royal Albert Hall in London. And about 2 weeks before, on August 22nd to be precise, they will return to the Elbphilharmonie Hamburg. The second half of the concert will be particularly exciting. Would Aurora be an ordinary orchestra? It would be safe to say that in this second half of the show, there would be the sheet music of Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring on their stands. But it just happened so that the Aurora decided to let go of all of it, and even the chairs to sit on. In other words, rather than trying to keep their nose above the raging waters of this infamous Stravinsky score by holding on tight to what has been written down in the sheet music, they play it all from memory, all of them. No sheet music, no stands, no chairs. This claim might hint to a kind of a circus act in the music circus. It is so much more. In this podcast, three members of the orchestra talk about what this way of making music means to them and about the other specialties Aurora Orchestra has in stock. I spoke with Nick Collen, founder and conductor of the Aurora Orchestra, his wife Jane Mitchell, principal flute and creative director, and Amy Harmon, principal bassoonist. And I am Tom. Enjoy our conversation. So happy to see you three and to talk to you three, Jane Mitchell and Nick Collen and Amy Harmon from the Aurora Orchestra, which is going to perform a second time in the Grand Hall of the Elbphilharmonie this August, on the 22nd to be precise. Thank you so much for having followed my invitation to talk to you.
Lovely to be here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the voices in their order. The first one was Nick Collen speaking, and Nick is the founder and conductor of the orchestra. And the second one was Amy Harmon, who is the principal bassoonist. And Jane Mitchell is flutist and general organizer of the and artistic head, I think, of the Aurora Orchestra. First question would be, did you found this orchestra together, Jane and Nick, or did you actually kind of meet in this orchestra?
To good get question.
Very personal, right? From the
no,
start.
No, very personal. No, we met a while before Aurora started. So we met whilst at university. We were both at Cambridge University doing music together in the same college. And Aurora started a few years later, just after moving to London. So it's now nearly 20 years old.
And it is not a secret to say that you are a married couple. And of course, my journalist's curiosity wants to know, did the love grow within the orchestra, or were you already a couple when you started the orchestra?
Yeah, no, very pre-Aurora. But actually, you've got the best other person on the Zoom to talk about this, because
okay.
Amy, I believe, met her now husband whilst playing in Aurora.
Oh, right.
Is that correct,
so,
We didn't actually meet in Aurora. We met in the Philharmonia, but we got together after a memorized prom. So I can always remember our anniversary and the Beethoven 6 prom as the same day.
Oh, nice. So Aurora is crucial in many ways, also for the family and love development department, so to speak. I was wondering, Nick, when you founded this orchestra, I mean, calling an orchestra Aurora is quite auspicious, isn't it? I mean, it's the morning red of the rising sun. What kind of rising did you envision would take place with this orchestra?
So the absolute truth is that I had nothing whatsoever to do with the name.
Okay.
The name came before me. And actually, the name was suggested by a brand consultant.
Oh, really?
Marketing team, yeah, who've been with us since the beginning. And in truth, I didn't like it very much when it was first suggested, but other people did. And I really like it now, actually. I don't know why I didn't, but it's great. It works really well. I suppose it was the idea of a new dawn, a new beginning, the sun rising, endless new possibilities, a new day. Yeah.
Because I don't know how aware you are of that, but pronouncing Aurora for the non-English native speakers is a hell of a crucial and difficult thing to do with this double rolling R, and everybody's like, you know, swallowing their tongues. But red, it's very classic, I would say. So it's not a bad name at all.
Yeah, and it can be all sorts of different colours, because Aurora is the northern lights, you know, that you get up in Finland and Norway. Which
Aurora
greens
Borealis.
And yeah, and yellows and blues and all sorts of things. So you're absolutely right. It's not only foreign speakers who struggle. Actually, there's quite a lot of even British speakers who can't say their R's. Aurora Orchestra.
Oh, that's a solace.
And that's it's problematic. Yeah,
because it's three R's actually. Aurora Orchestra. R's. And you're just like totally done with it.
Exactly.
But of course, the thought behind would be: Did you think right from the start, I want to work with musicians who have the balls, to be honest, to really play without sheet music, without chairs, without stands? Was that right at the beginning, or did that develop during?
No, that came later. The first time we did that was in 2014, so the orchestra was 10 years old by that point.
But the idea could have been born before.
Yeah, I think the idea came out of also just exploring different ways of presenting music. Definitely. And but it was quite a departure to suddenly do that. Was in the BBC Proms, it was doing Mozart's 40th symphony from memory, and that was just a new idea, and it stuck really with us. It's not all that we do, though. We do quite a lot of music with or performances with sheet music as well, but it's a really enjoyable thing, I think for the players, I can say on their behalf, I hope, and for me, and for the possibilities for creatively what we do with it. And so we do about two or three projects a year with memorized music, and it's very exciting.
In all those I was just gonna say, in all those years before we memorized a symphony, we were already thinking a lot about how you can present music and collaborate with other art forms and theatrical ways of sort of telling stories through concerts. And it still is when we use the music. It is amazing what percentage of your time planning those concerts is spent thinking about music stands and where to put them and sheet music and how to turn pages. It's such a logistical nightmare and barrier to so many things that I think it was always sort of a dream of what if we did some of these concerts without music. But it took us a long time to feel kind of confident enough to really try that in a big way. Music stands are more present than you could imagine. As soon as you try and do something interesting with music, it becomes quite a lot about logistics. And it was joyful when we realised actually you can do a lot without any music on the stage. So it opened up so many possibilities.
Yeah, it does free you in many ways, but in other ways, I mean, it's very demanding. And learning these parts, I think, is something that will take quite a long time. I mean, you have begun with Mozart. And that must have already been, I mean, technically probably not so difficult, because the parts, you know, it's more regular also in terms of the rhythmics. And then you came at some point to Berlioz, and now you're daring to tackle the Rite of Spring. And Amy, it's an easy part for you because you are going to start with the solo bassoon. So starting is never, I think, difficult to do without sheet music, right?
I think I've got the first 3 minutes down and probably have known the first 3 minutes for about 20 years. But the rest of it, on the other hand, and I think there's about 26 minutes after my solo that I have to master. But it's certainly a piece that any bassoonist could play off by heart, the opening. But then I was thinking the other day, actually, I really should look at the music and be really sure that I know exactly what is there, because I've played this piece many, many times and I never look at the music when I'm doing the solo. But actually, I think when we do memorized projects, we have to really honor it in a different way. So I'm going to make sure I know exactly where the half notes and the slurs and the dynamics and everything is.
And the accents and stuff.
Yeah.
But isn't that the frightening part, to know the piece so well and then to not know it at all at the same time once you take the sheets away?
I think what is so magical about these memorized projects is that we all end up knowing the score like we were a conductor or like we were a composer. You have to learn not just your part, you have to learn everyone else's parts. You have to learn all the nuances, all the structure, because otherwise you'll get lost and it's terrifying. So you have to dedicate yourself to this piece before you even get to the first rehearsal. And that never usually happens orchestrally. People, if they're dedicated to their orchestra, will turn up having looked at the music, but will they have spent 4 weeks looking at the score? Probably not. So it really makes us way more into the piece than we otherwise would be.
Could you give me a percentage of how much time you dedicate to a piece that you know you are going to perform by heart versus pieces you just have to learn parts and pieces, like a Verdi opera or something?
So for the memorized projects, I usually start about 3 or 4 weeks before the first rehearsal to memorize it. I used to start a lot longer before, but then I'd find that I'd peak too soon and I would then spend weeks playing it through and questioning myself. So actually, I've worked out that the sweet spot is 3 or 4 weeks for me, and I will always have the score when I'm practicing and have my recordings, multiple different recordings with me, and I'll listen to it when I'm not practicing, and you really immerse yourself in it. Whereas if I were to play a Verdi opera or something, I'd look at the hard bits in my part, I'd listen to it, and that would be it, really. I would sometimes bring a score to a rehearsal, but it just wouldn't be in anywhere near the same way that we all have to know these pieces when we memorize them.
So there's also one part of playing along with existing recordings, so that you get to get familiar with what the other players are doing when your cue comes in.
Exactly. And it's really interesting what you can find in recordings as well. I remember when we were memorizing a symphony, a bassoonist in a very, very good orchestra actually came in the wrong place. And I kept thinking, I don't know this page at all. And then I realized that poor bassoonist, they didn't pick the edit when they were in the right place. So
yeah.
It's really interesting, actually.
I would add to that, I've listened to quite a few recordings of the Writer's Spring. It is amazing how many have the wrong number of bars in them. I mean, that's not the conductor or the orchestra's fault, that's the producer's fault when they edit them. About three of the most famous recordings, people don't notice unless they know the music, just don't have the right, they've edited it wrongly, chopped a whole two bars out. And that is sort of only noticeable when you know the piece quite well.
I wonder, because I think I have never heard one performance that was like completely correct from start to ending, even though I can't really tell that I would know all the bars, of course, but you get a sense of, oh, at that point they really kind of lost it. What's your own tolerance in terms of we're going to play this by heart? Is it you'll be fine with 85% right notes, or where is it?
I mean, I guess the piece is often loud and busy and there's a lot of texture going on, so I can't totally comment on what everyone is doing, but I can't see how you could play a piece like this and not, you have to be able to play everything right, otherwise you just get lost. Although Amy, you said that you've played the piece a lot and you've never played the end right, is that correct?
So the last three pages for me, there's five bassoons, well, three bassoons, one doubling, one contra in my section, and we all play different things at the end. And despite how many times I've played this piece and frantically counting semiquavers, I often have to tass it myself in a few bars because I'm so confused. And why I'm so excited to memorize this is because it will finally cure my fear of the last few pages, because I can't possibly be counting semiquavers and frantically looking at my part. I just have to know
it. There is no part.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It doesn't feel more risky necessarily. I mean, if you turned up to a memorized project and hadn't put the work in, obviously that would feel terrible, but actually it's you can make mistakes with the part in front of you, you know, miscounting bars almost more than just trusting your brain, which has worked hard at it for months. It's a real exercise in trusting yourself and knowing that you know it, and it does, if you put the work in, it doesn't feel more risky. It feels all sorts of other things, but not necessarily more risky.
Even though you don't have any cue notes, because you can still, you know, lose it and have the cue notes and know when to go back into your part.
You know,
you have to do this by ear.
What's interesting about these projects is whenever I listen back to our broadcasts of the memorized symphonies, I think that sounds like the best recording. Like we've been in a studio for 2 weeks trying to get this perfect. And I think the reason is that the fear element means that everyone is hyper aware and super engaged and everyone knows it backwards and people are really completely in the performance. There's no section where there's someone whose mind is thinking about what they're going to make for dinner tomorrow or something. You know, everyone is absolutely fully committed. And so it ends up sounding, I think, tighter and neater and kind of more perfect than even if you had a well-honed symphony orchestra with the music.
I think I can echo on that also in terms of what the audience, you know, the degree of how much the audience is captivated by what's happening on stage, because it totally translates to the people who are listening to you, because it's like a high rope thing going on. And at the same time, it's so good so that you see they can actually do it. They won't fall, you know, and this is something that then again enables people maybe to support this momentum to last in a way.
Yeah, my sense is that people watching forget quite quickly that we're playing from memory. I'm not sure they're sitting there the whole time thinking, oh, what's it? You know, if you go to a violin recital and they turn up and they stand in front of the piano and they start their Beethoven sonata, it doesn't occur to you to worry about their memorizing, does it? You just enjoy their interpretation. And I think to a degree with an orchestra, because it's unusual, you might notice it for a little bit, but after a while, once, unless things are happening that are not supposed to happen, you just let that go and you're just aware of the other benefits, which are, I think, seeing a heightened sense of communication between the players.
Within the players, yeah.
And also just more energy. I think, like, because we're standing up, but also because we're able to look out and up, there's just more visual energy. And I think that is sometimes missing in some orchestras. Not in the best performances, you know, but it certainly feels like there's more energy and more spontaneity as well.
I was asking myself, you know, 50 years ago or so, we were beginning with Nicolas Hanoncourt and some brilliant musicians from Belgium and from Great Britain too, with all this period instrument music and historically informed playing. And sometimes they were, of course, the trailblazers, the pioneers of this movement. And is there a sense within you that you also might be pioneering a development in music making that might, you know, be contagious to other orchestras to say, okay, they have been the first, but why shouldn't we also try to... And is this maybe already happening and they are asking you for advice? How did you do it? And can you maybe just help us do such thing?
I mean, I think that is happening and we do get lots and lots of people interested and asking, and lots of, you know, music colleges and students are more and more interested in both the memorizing and the theatrical presentation. Of course, those two things often go hand in hand. And, you know, we do notice, oh, look, that group's presenting this from memory. But I think also at the core of our ideas, it's quite important for us to just think about ourselves in a way. I think, you know, it might be a byproduct if we come up with a really great idea that people do it, but we don't really come up with those ideas in order for that to happen. I think it's quite important for us to, you know, so not innovating for its own sake. It's because we wanted to do something with this piece of music for this reason, and it has to be about the piece of music and about that performance there and then. Then if something happens and other people react to it, that can be brilliant, or it can be not brilliant. But for us, it's really important to just really be focused on why we're doing this performance like this,
okay,
and keeping that kind
so
of...
So there is no missionary impetus in you to say, this is how maybe more people should look at music and play it.
I don't think we believe it in that way. I think the period instrument movement is so vital and so important and needed people who saw the relevance for all musicians, and we have all been influenced by that. It's totally changed music. I would never stand up and say that the concept of memorizing needs to change music and other people's music making in that way, because I don't, it's not an equivalent, but it's certainly changed how we do it, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it comes with a sense of should. it's a sort of could more. It's a sort of invitation and an experiment, really. And I think with so many things that we do, it's just kind of being brave enough to try. And I suppose if there's anything we would say other people, well, what I hate the word should in terms of other groups, but it would be that, be brave and try things. Whatever you want to try, that would be more our message, really. But we don't.
There are
really
so
think
many things
you
can
terms.
Try in music. I mean, speaking of repertoire, or you know.
And I think sometimes, you know, the great orchestral works, people feel quite afraid of, I don't know, being silly or funny or vibrant or trying something new, because they're so steeped in so much tradition and sort of reverence. And that's, you know, for good reason. And that's great. But I think it's we find it really liberating to just try and think beyond that a bit.
So with the Rite of Spring, you are doing something that you've already done with the Berlioz, which is, and you have mentioned it already two or three times, the theatrical element of your performance, that there is narrators telling stories, actors moving, musicians moving on stage, lights going on, you're having a mise-en-scène, which is, and you are doing this in the Royal Albert Hall even twice in a row in early September. And of course, I'm a bit envious, because I wonder, why don't you do this also in the other places? Is it just technically too difficult? Or would you, if you had enough time for preparation, do something specific for Elbphilharmonie, for instance, in a later stage?
Yeah, it's a good question. We are doing it like that because it's a huge production, effectively. It's very, very expensive and technically very complicated. And it would take several days in the venue to be able to get the lighting and the projections and all that sorted. And that's not possible when touring. So when we're touring our little tour in Germany, we are playing the piece just from memory. But it feels like the Just is doing quite a lot of hard work there, because it's so different for audiences done like that. And it's such a challenge with this piece that I think it will feel like quite a monumental thing, and actually
in itself.
We're very excited to do that in the Elbphilharmonie. I mean, the Berlioz was so exciting there. Was it last year? It was last year, wasn't it?
It was last year. It was last year.
it's gone pretty quickly. And it was so thrilling to do that. And the Rite of Spring will take the roof off.
Totally, totally. And I mean, with all the rhythmical things going on there and this insane intricacies that Stravinsky has written, I'm really very much looking forward to see you guys excel in this. But still, I mean, going back to Royal Albert Hall, I think this is a 5,000-seat venue or 6,000-feet venue, even with, you know, people standing in the circle in the middle. Are you selling out those two shows, or are they already sold out?
I don't think they're already sold out. They will. They'll get close, I'm sure. Yeah.
Because you are just like the hit thing happening.
No. Right, just now. because most of the concerts there do sell pretty well, and it's an amazing festival. You know, they have 80, 90 concerts, and they do all sell. I've been to one last week. It was sold out. You know, there's a surprisingly still a huge appetite for classical music.
I happen to have heard a Rite of Spring in the Royal Albert Hall not too long ago, a couple of years back, before COVID hit. And coming from Elbphilharmonie and the neat, tiny little concert halls in continental Europe, it felt like, wow, even this massive piece was far away. So sound-wise, it was not that easy to get this energy momentum going in this grand hall. Are you afraid of losing some of that probably in the Royal Albert Hall, or will you just have enough musicians to make sure there's enough power and sound behind?
I feel like we're an orchestra that have thought about the Royal Albert Hall. I mean, we can tell you sort of what every stage dimension and seat is, you know, from planning these projects. And one of the reasons thinking about standing up, playing from memory, making that impact, actually historically has been just the experience of listening to an orchestra in the Albert Hall. You know, whenever we program, we've been programming proms for more than 10 years, and, you know, proms for children, proms for families, late night proms. And, you know, occasionally we think about amplification, we think about staging, we think about actors, because it is such a huge space to fill. And I suppose it's interesting, actually, that probably is one of the reasons why we've thought about standing up and playing from memory and just kind of making that impact. And so it helps in the Albert Hall. It will help those people right at the back hearing a Rite of Spring stood up from memory with everyone giving their blood and guts and sweat and tears. I'm sure that element will project more to those faraway seats, and we are thinking about that all the time.
Yes, and then the ears will just follow because you sense the energy that's happening, and then
yeah, I think so. It is vast. We'll still be far away, hopefully, yeah.
Amy does quite well out of the Albert Hall because it's good for very loud stuff. It's also good for individuals. You can have like one violinist playing, you know, Yo-Yo Ma did the Bach cello suites, for example. Wonderful. 7,000 people can hear one player. I'm sure, no pressure, Amy, but the it is
the
quite
star. An embarrassing.
The
star will be
heard.
With
the start of your note, yeah, will be heard unless someone's coughing. I mean, I went to the Rite of Spring there, which Simon Rattle did with Berlin Philharmonic, which was, I don't know, 15 years ago. And famously, that was... It was the old Nokia phone call.
Yeah.
And he walked off the stage, and then we all thought, oh my God, is he coming back? Is that it? That was our Rite of Spring. It was about two bars of bassoon. And he came, and then the poor bassoonist had to do it all over again.
Yeah. I've had that with a phone actually at the start of the Rite of Spring. I think it was in this amazing converted bullfighting rink in Portugal, which was the coolest concert hall, I think, probably apart from the Elbphilharmonie, which I've yet to play in. And it was amazing, amazing venue. And I was just about to start, and I'd done my calming myself, getting my blood pressure nice and low, exhaled all my air, everything was perfect. I was about to start, and then someone's phone went off, and Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's conducting, just stopped us for about 3 minutes. And that's a good challenge that I like to tell my students, of how to re-find your calm to start again.
But I think it's very educational, you know, because at the latest point, then people realize, well, maybe I better choose flight mode or whatever, you know, turn my phone off, because maybe you should incorporate it in your inaugurational moment to just have this little song and then the phone.
But it sounds
in
a bit like a phone ring. The beginning of it. Could be a sort of weird new.
I'm going to have more of a 3D sound than a phone ring.
Yeah. Totally. Jane, unfortunately, you are not going to play, as I've learned in this piece, but you will still be coming to Hamburg and, of course, witness this concert. What are the next big things that you are planning, probably, in terms of playing from memory?
Oh, well, I don't know which are secret and which are not. Actually, the next big project I've just been working on will have elements of memory but isn't totally memorized is Hans Zender's Winterreise, which is incredible. We did a few years ago with the tenor Alan Clayton, but we're doing a big staging of it in March next year, and that it's a bit like the Rite of Spring. It's such a gift for the way we present music, because of course the players can become storytellers, and there's so much to uncover in terms of those songs and the texts. And
would you be using the score of Hans Zender's, or what score would you use?
We will, and then there will be moments where certain players will memorize certain movements and interact with the singer. So it's kind of it will be a bit of a hybrid version, and you know, there's plans for the orchestra to move position on the stage and use a lot of lighting and props and all sorts of things. So that's kind of already my mind is beginning to go towards that. And we're bringing back some of our memorized projects next year. We're revisiting Beethoven 3, Eroica. There's plans for the Firebird to come back. There is another Beethoven symphony which is on the horizon, but I don't know whether we can say that. No, but yeah.
So one of the eight remaining, it will be.
One of the, yeah, you can take a guess. Yeah. It's great. We love bringing back the memorized projects, and it's great revisiting them, actually. And it's also incredibly reassuring as a player. It comes back quite quickly, even if there's been a gap of 2 years. You think, on the first day, you think, oh gosh, I've got to start completely from scratch. And then 2 days later, you're like, oh no. It's back. I mean,
they're in there forever. It's so crazy how your brain can store these things. Whenever I do these pieces not with Aurora, if I ever do them with a symphony orchestra or something, I always challenge myself to see how long I can keep my music closed for. And I can pretty much do all of them now.
So it's kind of a cellular memory that stores the info that you need to. That's brilliant.
Yeah, our brains are amazing. It's been quite a good voyage of discovery in our sort of middle old age.
It's so interesting, and wherever I've memorized the different pages, whenever I'm playing it, I kind of can see that view out of the window. Like I memorized quite a lot of Eroica when I was on holiday in Tuscany, and whenever I'm playing it, I just completely can see your brain just goes like, oh, that's where I was.
Yeah,
I memorized.
So
that.
It does reproduce the images of when you were rehearsing it. Oh,
there's a dress I wore because on a summer day, the last page of Berlioz, it was like, oh yeah, that dress. Yeah, yeah. Then I can play that page. Yeah.
I can't remember any clothes that I've worn recently.
You're not that visual.
Well, actually, I started learning The Rite of Spring on holiday on a Greek island about 15 years ago. And I thought, I'm going to do The Rite of Spring from memory, because this was when I first conducted it. Yeah, I really, really want to memorize it. Absolutely nowhere near. I spent so long trying to learn it, and I couldn't do it at all. And then I did it last October, and I thought, I'm going to learn it, because I've got to do it from memory next year. I really tried, and I did about 2 bars. So it's been a really steep learning curve. But then something sort of broke through about a month ago, thankfully.
How long has it taken you, Nick? I'm so curious as to how
quite
long.
Quite a long time, actually. Quite a long time.
When I've never really looked at the score before, but now I'm memorising it, and I have a split screen on my iPad, which is what I use to memorise it, where I have the score on one side and my part on the other. And I'm like, this score is crazy. Like, all the different parts and, you know, like five clarinets all doing different things. And it's so intricate. And that's what's so fun about memorising it, is that you get to, like, appreciate all of that. But probably less fun for Nick. It's probably more scary.
It's just quite hard, right? I mean, it's just the repetitive things, the patterns are annoying. They are deliberately so, obviously, but you think you have understood why he's done it, and then you just don't understand. And also, when it's at speed, I find, I think, I really know that, and then just something goes, or you're distracted, and then you can't get back on.
And it's so, it reminds me so much of studying for my advanced maths exams when I was 18, where you desperately be trying to find a pattern or the answer within this huge page of numbers that you've got. And when you finally find something, you go, oh, and that's what it is in The Rite of Spring. I've just been spending days and days looking at half a page, and then you work out sort of some way to hook into it.
That's utterly fascinating, yeah. I mean, the conductor is conducting by heart always is fascinating, but with this piece particularly. How many bars in total are there? I mean, you were just talking about the first.
It's not very long.
It's not very long. I mean, it's, I don't know, 30 minutes or so. But coming from the Elbphilharmonie Concert Hall, that's so much dedicated to educational work of all sorts. I know that you also have a big heart and give much effort to education with your orchestra. Where are you on this right now? I mean, you're giving materials for schools. How much time and energy does it take from your artistic work to do this, which is also an artistic part of your work, I guess?
A lot of time. It's a big part of what the orchestra do. And we have, 4 members of our team who are totally dedicated to that side of things, including 3 members of staff who work part-time for the orchestra and then part-time in schools as classroom teachers. About a year ago, we felt it was really important to actually be regularly working with people who are also regularly working in the classroom. Trying to really break down that idea of orchestras kind of going and visiting and delivering lovely things, but then exiting. So really trying to get to the bottom of what could an orchestra do that would embed or encourage or help or enable music education in a really sustainable and long-term way. We're doing a few different programs at the moment, but the big new development for us is a set of resources that are available for schools to subscribe to online, which allow them to deliver a music program that we've designed in their classrooms and embedded within the website teacher training programs. In the UK, a lot of classroom teachers are asked to deliver music, but they don't have that much experience, and a lot of them feel not very confident. Exactly. And there's a lot of barriers around music. People feel they can't sing, they feel they don't they're unqualified. And so we've really, over the last 2 years, we've been really looking at how you can help teachers feel more confident and give them all these steps to be able to deliver music themselves, as well as helping teachers who are brilliant at teaching music just have lots of new ideas. So that's been we've made films, we've designed this whole site, and we've recorded lots and lots of music for them to use. So that's been a really exciting new thing for us.
And there's a good response on the school side, I guess. I mean, they will be happy to have this material, right?
Yeah, it's great. I think it's quite a unique thing that's out there. And I think this idea that they're just accessing incredibly high quality music is really new to a lot of schools. A lot of, you know, the recordings they use or the backing tracks for singing very rarely even feature live instruments in schools. So the fact that we're making these materials where, you know, you have Amy playing the bassoon, and they can sing a song with her. That's completely, there's not much out there at all like that, where they're really getting to perform and see and learn with professional musicians, and that can happen in any classroom anywhere in the country. So yeah, it's really exciting.
And this is basically voluntary work, or do you have some serious funding? I've seen that you have done the video, trying to collect some money before Christmas for this. Do people respond to this? Do they support you, like also on the financial side?
Yeah, they really do. Yes, I mean, it's always it's a balance of many things, and we work very hard at making all of that work. And there's lots of trusts and foundations as well in the UK that are helping us with that work. We're very well supported we have a partnership with the South Bank Centre. It's a big part of what the Arts Council in the UK are doing. So it's good for a lot of people. So we collaborate with people who help fund, and yeah, it's a complicated picture, but it's working at the moment.
And within the general difficult Brexit picture of music in the UK, it's one little sign of hope that you do this, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think we have to work really hard, which we're sort of up for. But as an orchestra, we have to really think all the time about why we exist, who we can help, what impact we can make. And, you know, in a way, those questions are exhausting, but they're also really challenging and brilliant. And, you know, they've made us do so many different things as an orchestra that we might never have thought of 10 years ago. So, you know, it, on the one hand, it's scary and tiring and, you know, always a challenge. But on the other hand, brilliant things can come out of those questions and being pushed to constantly think, who am I impacting and how can I help people is not a bad thing either.
So giving you a raison d'être beyond the many thousand people cheering you when you go to the Royal Albert Hall.
And exactly. Always thinking as wide and as big as possible, really.
So, I thank you so much for your time and telling you again how much I'm looking forward to your concert and to many more to come in good old Elbphilharmonie.
Thank you.
We really thank look you. Forward to being there. It's going to be great.
Beautiful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.